This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
We grew up in a two-story house in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn. The house had a balcony, and in the summer, we were able to sleep out on the balcony in the cooling air.
Hilton Alls is a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He wrote about his childhood in his most recent piece for The New Yorker, an essay called Homecoming.
The Brownsville summer of 1967 was like every other Brooklyn summer I'd experienced, stultifying. Relief was sought at the nearby Betsy Head pool and at the fire hydrants that reckless boys opened with giant wrenches. The cold water made the black asphalt blacker in the black nights. Gossip floated down the street from our neighbors' small front porches and from stoops flanked by big concrete planters full of dusty plastic flowers. Nursing a beer or a Pepsi, the grown-ups discussed far-off places like Vietnam. So-and-so's son had come back from there all messed up, and now he was on the methadone. Then the conversation would shift to the kids. Every kid in our neighborhood was everyone else's kid. Prying, caring eyes were everywhere. Sometimes the conversation stopped, but just for a moment, as girls in summer dresses passed. Men and women alike looked longingly at those girls for different reasons as they ambled down the street, pretending to pay no mind to the fine-built boys who called to them from a distance.
Hilton, you grew up in Brooklyn with your sisters and brother and your mother who had immigrated from Barbados. Can you tell me about that environment? And your mother, she was politically active, right?
Yes. Even though I don't think that she would ever say that she was a activist, she just kind of was active. She was a person who sort of found the political in the everyday, meaning believed very strongly in the possibility of the black family and doing better and having better. My mother was a proud member of Mary McLeod Bethune's National Council of Negro Women and had attended Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 March on Washington. When she reminisced about that march, it was with a vividness that made her children feel shy. Sometime in the long ago, Ma had been part of history. Nonviolent organization, picket lines, and marches, all these strengthened our mother's conviction that inclusion worked, that civil rights worked, that the black family could work, especially if welfare officers and other professionally concerned people, journalists and sociologists say, paid attention to what a black mother built rather than to how she failed.
Hilton, in 1967, something happened that really changed the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There was an uprising, or what was then called a riot. And it started in a way that was all too familiar. What happened?
There was a first a demonstration and then a riot when a young boy named Richard Ross was shot in the back by, as it turned out, a black police officer because it had been thought or assumed that he had mugged an older white man. And that event, that murder, precipitated a two-day period of discord and sadness. Standing by my mother's living room window, I tried tentatively to ask her why our world was burning, burning. She gave me a forbidding look. "Boy, be quiet so you can survive," her eyes seemed to say. Did I want to be another Richard Ross? One of the 100 or 1,000 Richard Rosses out there? So many questions I could not ask. Among them, had our desire for community also been reduced to rubble and ash? The chaos that night, it would last for 2 days before life went back to normal, was more vivid to my burgeoning writer's mind than what I could not see. Our mother's vivid memories of King's promise of a promised land. Where was that?
You write in your essay about the riots and the question of masculinity.
Uh-huh.
You said that to riot was a rejection of maternal silence. Talk to me about that and how you yourself fit into it.
I think that a lot of black men who are raised in matrilineal societies have to figure out not how to be men, but how to enact masculinity. And one of the things that they, and certainly I was taught, was how to be silent in order to save your life, which is don't question or contradict authority to its face because you might get smashed, you might be sent to jail, you might be killed. And I think that one of the things that happened and happens in riots is that boys are given an opportunity to imitate the sort of violence and freedom that they see their white counterparts having. It's a way of not only separating from the mother, but a way of competing with male whiteness.
There comes a time in your essay that you're you. You're the adult you. You're Hilton Alls, who's a successful, celebrated writer, living a decent life, a creative life. And yet, even in from established people in the cultural world, there's one slight after another. And I wish you would talk about experiencing that, how often it comes, and is it totally expected by you?
It's very interesting, David, that it's the writer's ego and egotism that believes that once you write something like this, that all racism will disappear and people will behave decently. But I came to visit some friends in Connecticut, and I got out of the car to go to the grocery store, and I had my mask on like everyone else, and there were two elderly white women, and I was sort of coming up the rear, and one of the women sort of flinched. She was startled by my presence, and she was making an effort not to be afraid. But still, in that effort, I felt great sadness because I wouldn't be afraid if she came up to me, or my mother wouldn't be afraid. What is it in the white body that I really want to ask the question, what is it in the white body that produces that response? It is very curious to me. I've never understood it. It has nothing to do with, you know, if you want to talk about the relationship of black violence and white violence, I think white people you know, have us beat by a mile. I don't understand why. It sort of feels like I have to ask the question back to you. I don't know why it's in that culture and in that body. It's sort of like that wonderful exchange with Toni Morrison had with Charlie Rose, where he says, well, you're celebrated, and do you still experience racism? And you can see her face turn into granite. And she says, that's not the right question. The right question is, why does it exist in you? So I'm sort of in that school. I feel it when it happens. I don't expect it. I don't go looking for it. And I think that that's partly what's assaulted is my relative innocence, my belief that as human beings we're going to, you know, go to the supermarket together or sit down together or have a meeting or lunch together, and no one leaves the table feeling slimed. It's really, there's that wonderful Public Enemy album, Fear of a Black Planet, but I don't know what the fear is. Why wouldn't you want a black planet?
I'm talking with The New Yorker's Hilton Alls. Now, we're at a moment when so many white people are out marching for racial justice and seem to be recognizing the damage of systemic racism on our entire society. Hilton concludes his essay, Homecoming, by thinking about just why this is happening, what changes in America have led to it.
You get it only when the shit happens to you, too. We all know that. And now the effects of our segregated democracy are happening to you. And now you can see or understand that all along, I've been trying to get along just like you. The way Ma taught me, to be independent and help my chosen family. I've tried to make a living at something I love and to explore the intricacies of love just like you. I've lost friends and forgotten to pay a credit card bill just like you. But I wasn't allowed to be like you. And now my other is happening to you. Now degradation and moral compromise and your body breaking down are happening to you. Because Donald Trump has happened to you. OxyContin has happened to you. Broken families have happened to you. Gun violence in schools, in supermarkets, in movie theaters, at concerts has happened to you, along with riots and frustration and cops who can't pass up an opportunity to flash their guns and their batons in your presence, even as you search for home, even as the dream comes tumbling, tumbling, tumbling down.
Hilton Alls, reading from his essay, Homecoming. It's a wonderful essay. I can't urge you strongly enough to read it. It's at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This Sunday should have been the 50th annual New York City Pride celebration. Last year, 5 million people turned up. This year, and it's no surprise, the parade was canceled because of the pandemic. But there is a Pride event on the streets of New York on Sunday of a very different sort. It's called the Queer Liberation March. Its organizers, who are called Reclaim Pride, formed their own march last year, and they rejected the way the official Pride parade had evolved over time and gone, in their view, mainstream, with all the corporate floats, a contingent of uniformed police marching, and what they saw as excessive control by the police department at every turn.
There was a lot of pent-up demand for something like this. A lot of longtime activists had just stopped going to Pride. They just did not want to be a part of it. They were kind of sickened by it.
Reclaim Pride ultimately decided to go ahead with the Queer Liberation March. No corporate floats, no barricades, no announced route. And now with the big Pride parade canceled, it's the only game in town. Michael Shulman talked to four of the Reclaim Pride organizers.
So Michael, thank you so much for reaching out to us.
Well, thank you guys. Sorry that I missed it last year, but I'm glad you're so glad you're doing it again.
We got back together early fall to start planning this year's event, and then COVID hit. And the mayor announced there would be no public events in New York through the end of June. And so, you know, we did the only thing we could do at that time, which was to assume that we were not going to be able to have this march. Mm-hmm. So we shifted to a virtual idea. You know, all of this work was happening. And then we had the onslaught, first Ahmaud Arbery, then Breonna, and then when the nation saw George Floyd be murdered.
Right.
And the protests began in Minneapolis and New York and then all across the country. After that first weekend of protests, we had our meetings still scheduled for working on our virtual content. And there was unanimity that we needed to have a march and we needed to have it centered on the movement for Black Lives. And we had to be for abolishing the police, dismantling the police, defunding the police. There was literally not a single voice of dissension.
And so here we are. It's as if the COVID-19 meteor killed off the $12 million dinosaur parade, and a smaller, more resourceful organism survived to fill the void.
We're able to pivot in a way that a more complex plan wouldn't allow us to. Floats and stops for posing and being announced by a TV broadcast and all of these trappings that are part of a polished spectacle get in the way of having a effective community gathering.
I live in Greenwich Village, and last year, June came and it was like every Bank of America and Shake Shack had just rainbows coming out of the windows. Chipotle had a rainbow burrito. And I think there are some people who would look at that and say, that's fantastic. Like, acceptance has become so mainstream. And what would you guys say to that, to people who just feel, why complain?
Part of it is the sullying of our movement by association with corporate bad actors. These mainstream pride organizations pinkwash this very, very dirty money that's coming from these corporations that are doing enormous damage to our country and to the world. You know, Wells Fargo, for instance, had a huge marching contingent last year, and they're the banker of the NRA. And they're welcomed into Pride, and oh yes, you can have your Wells Fargo float in our Pride march.
To be clear, Chipotle did have a rainbow burrito, but it was on a tank top, and it was for a good cause. Anyway, the Reclaim Pride Coalition feels that their version of the march is the more authentic expression of the Pride tradition, one that pulls on the history of the Pride movement from 50 years ago, when the very first marches were organized by a group called the Gay Liberation Front.
They were a leftist group that was very intersectional. So they were anti-war, they were in solidarity with the civil rights movements, the feminist movements. They also had an alliance with the Black Panthers around the particular issue of police brutality. You know, this history has been lost to many in decades of assimilationism as the focus has turned on things like marriage and serving in the military and so forth. But the roots of this event are actually quite politically radical. Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, they were political revolutionaries. They really had a completely transformative view of society.
We also know Stonewall was a riot started by Black and brown trans people. Pride wouldn't exist without Stonewall, which was a riot. If you know your history, you would know you only have rights because people rioted and people spoke up and people did things that were dangerous for them. And we need to fight for people in that way.
This is Sylvia Rivera at the fourth ever Pride March in 1973, as revolutionary as they come. But listen to how she addresses her audience. She's not talking to a group of fellow radicals. She's yelling at them for being bourgeois conformists.
Did you do anything for them? No. I will not put up with this shit. I have been beaten. I have lost my job for gay liberation. And you all treat me this way? What the fuck's wrong with you all?
The tension between assimilation and radicalism was part of the movement from the beginning. It's always been there.
And not men and women that belong to a white middle class, white club. And that's what you all belong to. Revolution now! Give me a G!
The organizers of the Queer Liberation March see themselves in the tradition of Sylvia Rivera and other radical activists, but with only a few weeks to plan, some of their concerns were more practical than philosophical.
We have voted on a start time, 1 p.m. So for the queers that took umbrage at our 9:30 start time last year, we'll have a 1 p.m. start time, and it will happen in Manhattan.
Their timing is apt. Outside the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village, there's now a giant sign that says, Pride is a riot.
The New Yorker's Michael Shulman. He spoke with Natalie James, Francesca Barjan, J.W. Walker, and John Carter of the Reclaim Pride Coalition. This year, we've been talking on the program about mass incarceration, the fact that the United States imprisons its people at a rate unparalleled in the world. And when the coronavirus pandemic hit, we looked at a push by activists and prison officials to release some inmates as quickly as possible. In March, to take one example, the county jail in Cleveland reduced its population by almost half. 900 inmates came out with unprecedented speed, and one of them was a 36-year-old named Jermaine.
They was trying to stop it from spreading, so they were letting people out. That's how I got out.
Like so many incarcerated people, Jermaine suffers from mental illness, and he's addicted to drugs. That's true of anywhere from 20% to more than half of incarcerated people, depending on where you are and how you calculate it. In some counties, prisons are the largest providers of mental health care. And when Jermaine was released, the first thing he did was to vanish.
Nowhere to go, so it was just messed up, for real. It just was messed up.
As part of our collaboration with WNYC's United States of Anxiety, reporter Marianne McCune spent weeks following a psychiatrist and a social worker who were trying to find Jermaine and others like him during a time of chaos. Here's Marianne McCune.
A lot of us have someone in the family or someone close who is addicted to drugs or has some kind of mental illness, manic episodes or paranoia. They can't keep out of trouble, and we can't figure out how to take care of them. Those are the kind of people who end up in Dr. Testa's office.
Hi, Marianne. It's Meg Testa, psychiatrist from Cleveland.
Since I can't go see her myself,
I'm at the agency. I'm outside.
Dr. Testa has been recording dispatches from her office. And it's down to every little detail.
I'll be using this to call my patients.
Dr. Testa is a psychiatrist for people who churn in and out of the criminal justice system. So as they come out of Ohio's prisons and jails, she tries to keep them from going back in. That is, if she can find them. Ever since the local jails started releasing inmates rapid fire, Dr. Testa is struggling just to keep track of patients, much less treat them.
I'm like in my office one day. I'm trying to call a patient. I'm hanging it up. And my desk phone rings. And it's one of my patients that was my patient 2 years prior. And he had just been let out of a jail with no meds, no treatment, no nothing, and told to just give a promise to link up with his doctor. He did call me, but by this time, he was calling me to tell me how many banks he owned and how much money he had and how great he was doing because he was fully manic.
Dr. Testa has blurred some of the details of the case to protect his identity. She says there's no way a person in his state could consent to sharing his story. And she's giving him the name Bobby.
He was on the bus when he was on the phone with me. He's using drugs and alcohol. He's without treatment. He doesn't really think he needs treatment. He doesn't even know how to keep himself safe from coronavirus because he thinks the whole thing is like a trick by the government and it's martial law and it's a whole lot of nothing that he needs to be worried about.
Dr. Testa says this call from a bus, this is not the way to get started with a patient. If you want any chance of helping someone begin a new life after prison, you need to start the minute they walk out that gate. And what's missing right now more than ever is a handoff from the jail or prison to the people who can help.
The problem is that if we don't even know that they're out, we're going to lose them.
At this point, Bobby has had weeks on the street without medication, making choices that could hurt him.
How are you coping?
And all Dr. Testa can do is wait for his calls.
Any fever or coughing, anything like that? Trouble breathing?
It's possible
that
I'm just the only person in his life that he can think of that'll pick up the phone and talk to him right now.
I spend the next several weeks checking in to see how those conversations are going.
Good. Tell me about
Dr. Testa's
goal
to somehow coax him off the bus, off the streets, and into her office for help.
I know. We miss you, too. We miss you, too.
When she was young, Dr. Testa had a close family member with mental illness who, like so many, ended up behind bars. She remembers sending letters to the prison. Now she's part of a team of doctors and counselors and caseworkers whose mission is to help people with mental health problems exit the criminal justice system.
Good morning.
She works for Recovery Resources, one of a network of agencies that contract with the state and county to set up housing, health care, rehab, ideally the moment a prison is released.
They'll pick him up. They'll try to get his income sorted out. They'll take him to family services. They'll try to get him food stamps. They'll take him shopping. They'll get him clothing. They'll help him apply for jobs.
But when COVID-19 hit, they had to pull back dramatically to comply with Ohio's shutdown order. They can't drive people places. So much is closed anyway. Only a few people at a time are allowed to come to their office for appointments.
Good morning. How are you?
The normally full waiting room.
There's only one person there, kind of sitting in the corner wearing a mask.
A lot of their services, from psych evaluations to group counseling, are on the phone or over computers, which is hard for everyone.
Do you guys want to say hi? Nobody's saying hi.
They will. They're all muted.
Oh, okay.
Say
Who
hi.
Is it?
It's a reporter for that thing I'm doing.
Radio.
Radio.
Hi.
Annette Amistadi is a social worker Dr. Testa works closely with.
We have Dawn, the nurse.
She's also been recording herself while she spends a frustrating amount of time searching for the people she's supposed to be helping.
Did he give you the address?
Yeah.
I don't think we've had anybody.
Right now, she's trying to find Jermaine, who was among the 900 inmates released from jail in Cleveland after COVID hit. Jermaine has schizoaffective disorder, among other things.
So it is 11:48. It's Annette here trying to locate a client who was released from city jail without a plan, and I wasn't aware of his release. So now I am trying to figure that out. So I'm going to send this email now.
Jermaine was Annette's client last year when he came out of a longer stint in prison. They were making some progress, trying to treat his addiction and prescribing psych medication. But as is often the case, he got locked up again. She was waiting for information about his court dates and release. And then she found out, oh, he's been out for a week and a half. His parole officer emailed saying she has no idea where he is.
He is declared whereabouts unknown. But I am hopeful that, I don't even know, we can find something because he definitely needs help and this is a problem. So that's currently what I'm doing.
Over the weeks to come, Annette will be part social worker, part detective. Her mission? find Jermaine and pull him into the fold. While down the hall, Dr. Testa is waiting for that desk phone to ring with Bobby on the other end. She's especially worried about getting Bobby the right medication in time.
He's one of those guys that, like, he has a different treatment when he's in prison than he has when he's on the street.
This is something I'd never thought about, but mentally ill people are like all of us in that they behave differently in different settings. So Dr. Testa says a lot of her patients will have their prison meds and their street meds.
An example of that is called Zyprexa. Zyprexa is an antipsychotic medication, and it's really sedating. Some of my patients, they go, Zyprexa, that's my jail med. They feel like they can cope with their environment. They're more calm. They're less likely to overreact to other inmates and get in trouble and get in the hole if they're like a little bit sedated while they're in jail. But as soon as they hit the streets, they say, I'm not taking Zyprexa. That's jail meds. I want Abilify. It treats psychosis, but Abilify doesn't usually cause sedation. And so people will tell me, like, I need to be alert. I need to be able to watch my back. I need to be able to react.
Right now, Dr. Testa knows exactly what's going to help Bobby on the street because she's treated him in the past. A strong dose of an antipsychotic drug, an injection that lasts him for a month at a time.
I can say, like, we know you need your shot. Come on in and get your shot. But right now, when he's so grandiose and he's so amped and he's so into his delusions, and it's hard to come at him that way.
And every day he's out there without treatment, he's harder to reach. It's not like no one is trying to solve this problem. The medical director at the county jail says even when they released 900 inmates in March, their staff worked, quote, tirelessly to link inmates with the help they needed. Ohio and states across the country are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on programs to identify inmates with mental health problems and connect them to services. The problem is, even in the best of times, success rides on a patchwork system. It depends on what prison or jail you're in, who evaluates you, the judge who presides over your hearing, your parole officer, your social worker.
It's Annette. It is currently 2:02.
While she continues to look for Jermaine, Annette sends me updates about other cases she's working on, too. And there's this one that gives you an idea of the lengths to which she can go to smooth the way for someone when she knows ahead of time they're coming out.
I have an email from the institution where one of my clients who's getting out on Friday.
She's already done the hard part. She has a treatment plan and a group home in Cleveland. But now there's this minute detail of just how to get the woman from the prison 3 hours away to her new home.
They're not able to transport people.
The parole officer tells Annette they're putting her on a Greyhound bus.
So I'm like, okay, well, what time's the bus going to get back in here, like to Cleveland? The bus isn't even getting in here until like 11:30 at night. What the hell am I supposed to do to help somebody at 11:30 at night? How am I going to get her from the bus station in Cleveland to her group home, which is not close? This makes no freaking sense. To send someone on the Greyhound who's already been identified of having mental health issues, like, let's put them on a bus and say, figure it out. Like, what?
So Annette, who I should say is also a member of the National Guard, she did a tour in Afghanistan. She's kind of unstoppable. She keeps emailing and calling prison staff, the parole officer, trying to get an answer from the warden. And 2 days later, here she is.
Hey, it's Annette. It is currently 11:57 on Friday.
Driving to meet her client, and it's noon, not midnight, as originally planned.
She is getting transported up here by the officer.
Continue straight, then stay to the left to I-77 North downtown.
Which is really awesome. Thank you, GPS. And so now I'm, like, rushing to get there. Like,
Annette got the warden to agree to send the woman to Cleveland in one of the prison's big white cargo vans and to give Annette an ETA. So she's timed things so exactly that she thinks she sees the van driving right behind her.
I have good timing. Apparently, I am a miracle worker.
Turn right on Buckeye Road.
Hey, it's Annette. It is right around 11 o'clock.
Annette is still trying to track down Jermaine, 12 days after he was released from jail. And then, out of the blue,
He called me today. Yay! I'm so excited. And I'm going to go try to see him today at the shelter. I'm really hopeful he is there. But yeah, just was really excited. Wanted to share that.
He has found his way to a homeless shelter, managed to get a cell phone that he called her on.
Okay, that's the end.
And the next day...
I'm going to take it off speakerphone right now. I'm going to hand the phone...
This is Jermaine.
We're listening to Annette Amistadi, a Cleveland area social worker, and one of her clients, Jermaine. Our story continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're going to continue now our story about mental illness in prisons and what it means when inmates with mental illness get released. Over the last few months, many states have tried to reduce the populations in their prisons and jails because of COVID-19. It threatens everyone who lives and works in prison. But for some inmates, prison may also be the only place they've gotten consistent treatment for mental illness and addiction. A former inmate from Ohio named Glenn put it this way.
My reaction is they're in trouble. For the guys like now that are getting kicked out of prison, basically, with this coronavirus, they can't get in no place. There's no place they can go.
WNYC's Marianne McCune continues our story.
When Annette, the social worker, finally manages to meet up with Jermaine, she finds out the full story of what happened.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Annette has known Jermaine for a while. Last year, when he came out of prison the first time around, she and Dr. Testa did a lot for him. They set him up right away with an ID, applied for Social Security. He tried living with his mom in public housing, but caused too much trouble, and she had to kick him out or risk being kicked out herself. Annette was still trying to get him into the right program, but in March, Jermaine says he broke into a liquor store for a drink.
I had caught a break-and-entry case, and I got locked up, and they was... letting people out.
With COVID hitting jails and prisons, the county was trying to move people through fast.
They was trying to stop it from spreading, so they was letting people out with lower tier felonies. They were letting people out or reducing their bonds. So that's how I got out.
And when they said they were going to let you out, did they ask you, hey, do you have any mental illness or... addiction problems, or do you have a place to stay? Did they check with you about that stuff?
Yeah, they know. Yeah, they had records of it. The social worker come talk to me about it, uh-huh. And ask questions, and uh-huh. They gave me medication to leave. They gave me prescription. I got filled. It's enough for 2 weeks, I think, 2-3 weeks.
And they knew you didn't have a place to stay either.
Yeah, I'm supposed to go to the treatment center,
but then
they just let me out. They just scrapped all that, and it was just me. This I had to do on my own. So I went to 2100 Lakeside.
2100 is a shelter.
Yeah, I was in there before, so that's why I knew where it was at.
So they let you out of jail early because of social distancing, but then you had to go to a shelter where that was impossible.
Yeah, there's no way to practice social distancing in a homeless shelter.
Were you sober when you came out, and then were you able to stay that way? Or
Yeah, for a little while, then it went back to the same thing.
What did you do?
With as far as drugs and alcohol,
yeah.
PCP, crack, alcohol. That is how it is if you're dealing with things. So back to what you used to.
All right, it's Annette, right around 1 o'clock.
That first visit with Jermaine, Annette checks in from her car after they see each other.
Of course, he has no clothing because when you go to jail, you lose all your clothing. And before that, he was at his mom's. And of course, she threw all that away because she's sick of him. And so had to look into places that he can go get clothing on his own because I can't take him to get clothing. He lost his ID. He lost all of the stuff we spent the last year getting him because he did some really stupid stuff. But now I have to go figure out how I'm going to get him in to see the doctor, get his meds figured out, get all that other stuff figured out, because now that I located him, I kind of have to start all over.
There is one piece of good news.
He told me that the shelter is putting him in a hotel tomorrow. So I did not know this, but the shelter is putting people in hotels because they can't social distance and stuff down here, which is pretty freaking awesome. So fingers crossed, he calls me tomorrow like he's supposed to. And then I guess we'll go from there. Now on to the next person.
Annette is so persistently hopeful. But the next time she tries to get in touch with Jermaine, his phone line is dead.
The telephone number you have dialed is temporarily not in service.
A few days later, he leaves a voicemail. He's in the hotel the shelter moved him into.
Getting in the elevator here to see if I can find him.
She gets to his door.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is Jermaine in this room?
He's supposed to be, but he's not here.
He's not there? Okay. All right, thank you. Mind if I just push the down button really quick?
Oh, go ahead.
Excuse me.
So Jermaine is missing again. Annette, his social worker, is playing catch up. And the array of programs and people that could potentially help Jermaine, in a lot of ways, they are all part of a much bigger and longer game of catch up, a response to choices our country has made across two centuries.
I think we as a society, we have pushed mentally ill people off into certain places. So first it was asylums, and they needed a therapeutic place, and we pushed them there. And then when we decided that was inhumane, we let them out.
But we failed to create a nationwide network of mental health centers that was supposed to replace them. And in the decades to come, we turned increasingly to the criminal justice system to address all kinds of problems.
We criminalized addictions, and we criminalized a lot of mental illness behaviors, like nuisance behaviors, just hyper-criminalized all of it, and we pushed all these people away again. And the problem is, when people get out, we don't have our arms open for them. We just simply don't. They do fall in the crack. Should we have this problem? No, but we do.
So, like, you're trying to reply for all this stuff, and everything's, like, pretty much, boom, closed.
It's been almost a month since Dr. Testa was sitting here in her office, and that former patient she's calling Bobby telephoned her out of the blue from a bus, high on delusions about owning several banks.
I know. It's like anything you try to do right now.
He called a lot after that, and she started using what they call motivational interviewing to try to get him to come see her in person, which he finally did. For a first appointment.
Yeah, I would love to see pictures. Whenever you can come in the next time, it'll be like great.
She says by that time, he'd already gone from that manic state to something much less happy.
We call it dysphoric. It's like this irritable, paranoid state where whereas he had told me like that coronavirus was no big deal. It was like a fake thing that the government was putting out there and it wasn't even really a harm to him. He started really like fixating on that it was still fake, but that it was sort of reflective of this like religious war that was going to happen. And there was Wiccans involved. And what I said was, I said, I remember that you had some of these ideas in the past. And I could be wrong, but it's my recollection that when you took Risperdal, you started to think, like, why was I even thinking that? Like, why was I even feeling that way? And so he was willing to take like a light dose of the Risperdal. And so I was able to start that medication for him.
Hey, it's Annette. It's currently
3:52. The social worker is still so frustrated by what she's not allowed to do because of COVID. She keeps sending dispatches from her car venting about this or that challenge.
Turn left on St. Clair Avenue.
Here I am debating, do I get in trouble and transport somebody when the agency says I'm not allowed to because of the 6-foot rule thingy, right? Or do I do it to ensure my client's taken care of?
One encouraging development, she has managed to talk to Jermaine again and set up a time to meet back in that hotel room the shelter moved him into.
Put on my mask. All right, here we go. Fingers crossed. I'm hoping. I'm truly hoping.
She heads up in that same elevator.
The smell of marijuana is like super potent, so this is fun.
And then she's outside Jermaine's room again.
See how this goes.
I hear something.
Yay. Hey, Jermaine. How are you?
Jermaine. She's finally found him.
So you got your own room then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jermaine has a full-size bed to himself. He's got no roommate right now. There's a TV on a stand. And when they call on Annette's phone, Jermaine tells us he's been turning to a channel that, when you think about it, is either terrible or wonderful for someone like him. HGTV, home renovation shows.
The Scott Brothers, or Property Brothers, or watch that. How to build the houses and how they do the houses and stuff.
Oh, like the home improvement things? Yep, but I like to watch Chopped. I love that show. I don't cook for shit, Jermaine, but I like to watch it.
Meals are delivered to Jermaine's door every day. Lunch comes while Annette's there.
Lunchtime!
It's a mishmash. There's a tub of peanut butter, piece of peach cobbler. In the fridge, Jermaine has a big hunk of orange cheese they brought one day.
What is that? A whole thing of cheese.
They gave us this yesterday. We
like, what are you supposed to do with that? That's like, what, a pound of cheese? I don't know, 2 pounds of cheese?
That's what I said.
Well, you know what? I know it's weird, but it's food. You know?
Now that Annette has found Jermaine, she's lining things up for him, starting with his Social Security application so he can have some income. But Jermaine is stressed out. He just doesn't know what's coming. The world outside is still mostly shut down. He doesn't have a phone, says someone took it. And honestly, he says life felt easier when he was locked up.
Yeah, you ain't got that many worries in there. You don't have to worry about the clothes or nothing like that.
So does it feel harder now than when you were inside?
Yeah.
What's better about it?
You ain't got to know the pressures. You know what's coming to you and stuff like that, as far as you ain't got to worry about nothing.
Mm-hmm. Did when they told you that you were going to get out early from jail, what was your feeling about that?
You got to go back to struggling and stuff. So.
Would you have ever told them that you wanted to stay in?
No, you can't. Yeah, I do. I try, you can't.
You did you
ain't,
try?
They ain't about to let you do that. You can't do that.
When Dr. Testa first became a forensic psychiatrist, she says she used to congratulate new patients.
Like, they would have their first visit with me being released from jail or prison, and I would be like, how awesome that you're out. Like, I would just come right out of the gate with that. And for a lot of people, it is not awesome that they're out.
Dr. Testa is a big advocate of prison reform. She is definitely on the side of, we should not be locking so many people up, especially people with mental health problems. But given the way the system works now, she's finding herself at odds with people saying this is the moment for change.
It feels really bad to be like, guys, I can't be with you on this one. I think it's a bad idea. I wish that COVID was this golden moment and this is the time and now we're going to decarcerate everyone. That would be really awesome. We should have already been looking at this. We should have already been decarcerating. This is long overdue. We should already be doing this. But to want to do it at warp speed in the middle of a pandemic, that's where I get frustrated, because it's hard enough when someone comes out. And right now, now is just not the time.
Like many states, Ohio is beginning to open up, but there is still so much chaos. Courts are still holding video hearings. Probation and parole are still mostly on the phone. Annette still can't drive people places. And many of the organizations like hers that serve people with mental illness and addiction are now more financially strapped than ever.
I mean, I think it feels really bad as a society right now that we have all these people vulnerable, and now we have a pandemic, and now we're having to look at all that. But I don't think a lot of people are looking at, like, oh, this is what's best for this person. Like, let's get them out. If we were thinking about it that way, we would already done this.
Back in the 60s and 70s, when states across the country were trying to shut down big mental institutions, the idea was to put the money saved toward helping people live independently, put it toward treatment and counseling, and also housing and income. But the money didn't end up following the patients. Now, if we're going to release inmates with mental health problems from prisons and jails, the question is, again, can the money we were spending to hold them in custody go instead toward helping them live on their own? Will the money follow the patients this time?
Reporter Marianne McCune. Our story was produced in collaboration with WNYC's program, The United States of Anxiety. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.